Hi everyone, and welcome to episode 6 of One on One with me, Matthew Carrigage. On today's episode, we return to the world of motorsport, in particular, the realm of Formula One. This season has seen two titans of the tarmac in 7-time world champion Lewis Hamilton take on his biggest adversary yet, Max Verstappen. It is a title fight for the ages, and my guest today is someone who is the voice of Formula One for Channel 4 in the UK, as well as lending his brilliant commentary to Formula 3, Formula 2, and the W Series. He is the one and only Alex Jakes. We discuss the recent weekend at Spa-Francorchamps, the intense title fight, how Alex got into broadcasting, and so much more. I hope you enjoy our conversation. Alex, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. It's been a privilege to have you on. First of all, how are you? Of course, the Spa-Francorchamps event in Belgium, the Belgian Grand Prix, has just concluded. An interesting event, let's just say.
Yeah, Matthew, I think you could say an interesting event. Had some strange days behind the microphone, but I think that might be up there at the very top of the weird list, because we've had long delays in the past, but we've always eventually got something. And I have to say, there was a feeling from a long way out that the radar just wasn't saying what we wanted it to say. So I've been to that race. I've been to that race in very similar conditions in 2010 as a fan. Obviously, I've been to that race then as a broadcaster since. But as a fan, I've sat at Puan. I've sat on the Kemmel Straight. I've been there at silly o'clock to unfold my camp chair. We've been rained on sideways. We had a weird thing in a couple of years ago. I was talking to Will Buxton. It's actually after Robert Wickens had his horrendous IndyCar accident. And Buxton was talking about, do you remember this incredible thing when Robert Wickens worked out that if he just slowed the pack up, the rule was different. It wasn't the time ran out plus a lap. It was the time ran out and the checkered flag came out. And Robert Wickens worked it out and timed out the race. And Buxton's going into all this detail about it. And I'm like, hold on, I was here that year in the crowd. So why don't I remember it? Why I don't remember it is that I was on the Kemmel Straight underneath an umbrella praying the rain would stop, praying I could feel my feet at some point in the half hour. So having been there, it just felt like a gut punch, because we're in the middle of a all-time great world championship. We're off the back of the summer break. The fans have been there all day. They've been rained on all weekend. The majority of them are going back to tents that are not exactly in the driest condition. And then to not get any meaningful running, your heart broke for them, because that's one of those days where it's just not fair. And I think I said in commentary yesterday, that's the 18th Grand Prix to be affected by rain at Spa out of 54. There we are. One day later, I can remember my notes. Right. And that's the worst one. And that's what I couldn't believe, that we were watching the worst conditions possible in the history of the Belgian Grand Prix in a place famous for rain. And yeah, hugely disappointing day for Formula One. I don't think anyone would argue that. And I think the best thing I can say about it, Matthew, is that we get a chance to go racing immediately and take everyone's mind off what was a pretty downbeat affair.
Yeah, that's right. We get the triple header, essentially, we go to Zandvoort, of course, this weekend, and the next weekend, the Temple of Speed, Monza, which should be super exciting. I have to ask then, as you were broadcasting throughout the session, as it's unfolding, or as in unfolding as in nothing was really happening, how do you keep the audience engaged in that situation where there's not much happening on track, you know, as much as pretty much everybody else, you're waiting for something to happen? What is that conversation like with the audience, with DC, or how do you keep people engaged when really nothing's happening?
Well, I can't claim to have done much hard work yesterday, I have to say, because the Formula 3 race yesterday I did live, and then Channel 4 highlights we would record for a bit. We would cover off. The highlights process is interesting to talk about as well, because it is all done as live normally. And so we always do it. People think that we're going back and we're editing things, and maybe people get the wrong idea. But it's all done as live, and they have to edit it down for a program. So there's not much of an occasion to go back and correct anything. You just got it. So it's effectively a live broadcast normally. Yesterday, you get a gap. Now, last year on the Pit Lane channel, we had the Nürburgring where we were told fairly early on in the day, listen, you're probably going to have to fill all of the session all the way through on the practice day. So how do you, to answer your question of how you keep the audience engaged, I'll be really honest, and I think other commentators would agree with this. If it's not a serious red flag, it's not a problem. So if you've not had a really serious accident, because then you're very restricted with what you can say, and everything you say is important in that instance. And we actually had that this weekend with the W Series, with the big crash at Radeon there, where information was sparse for a moment, and then you're just repeating what you know, and everything you say in that red flag is of huge significance, because one wrong sentence and you're going to spark a panic. That's the nature of broadcasting. When there's a rain delay, you can make it wry and you can make it fun, and you know that everyone watching, if you are live at that occasion, you know that every, I'm not making a 15th cup of tea like I was, and you know that everyone is willing, you're all willing it to go in the same direction. Everyone's watching because it's their, often it's their favorite thing to do. If you're watching a rain delay, Matthew, and you're into hour two of the rain delay, it's because you love Formula One or motor racing. It's your favorite thing of the week. You've been looking forward to it. You're just so invested in it that there's almost a curiosity as well, in that we did an hour and 40 minutes for Formula Three, the first race of the weekend. Yep. And, you know, I said on Talkback at one point, this is going to be longer than the actual Italian Grand Prix is going to be, you know? It's absolutely ridiculous. So with that filling, I mean, I commentate on Formula 3 with Alex Brundle, and what everyone heard on air was essentially what we talk about in the commentary box anyway in the half an hour before we go live. So that was just like an insight that no one needed into our commentary box nonsense. So I think everyone is, I think that's a weirdly positive environment, in that I think everyone's pulling in the same direction, and you can have fun with that. And the pressure is off, because things have gone wrong, but it's not serious. And every occasion apart from yesterday that I can remember on a Grand Prix weekend, you eventually get a race.
You know, what's funny is I, as you'll come to see with the notes that I wrote, big on Formula 3 and Formula 2. So obviously I did watch the first race, and that kind of stuff is, I find that stuff amusing, more or less, that you kind of waiting for something to happen, and you, and in essence, what you did was bring everyone into the inner sanctum of what you guys do before the actual race, which to me is like, yeah. I'm like, I'm all about this. This is fantastic. And then we saw the race, which saw Lorenzo Colombo rinse the field in as comprehensive fashion, which was like, yeah, this is pretty sick. So
yeah,
let's talk about how you got into that Formula 2, Formula 3 world. Where did that opportunity come from? And since you are, you are the voice of Formula 2, Formula 3, W Series and F1, how do you juggle that weekend? Because there's a lot of commentary to go through. So what do you do to kind of like save your voice? Or I'm just curious, what's your kind of habitual ritual throughout the weekend?
Well, Matthew, that's a good question. To answer how I started, BBC local radio, I get a load of people ask me, how do you get into sports commentary? And it's slightly changing now. There are more opportunities, certainly with YouTube channels, certainly with esports. But I went along the lines of working with BBC Radio and a sports agency called Haters. It's just the guy's surname. That's just the guy's surname. It came, funnily enough, it came up all the time, spelt with a Y. Different story. Anyway, I digress. So I would just go around the country, in the UK. Anywhere that needed me, I would go. And that's the thing. You've always got to be available. So I got a body of work up, not a body of work, basically something I could send producers, which was a demo of me going, yeah, I can make Cardiff. The answer was yes for 3, 4, 5 years. Started with non-league football, with YouTube channels, progressed to local radio, then made a sports agency. And it meant that I covered everything from non-league football 1 week to motor racing the next, to cricket the next, to the Olympic test events. Where I was doing fencing, and I didn't know a huge amount about fencing, but you do your homework, you go, you pick up the microphone and you interview them afterwards. And what that does is it prepares you to do something all the time. So when GP2 came up, which was a simple application, it was find the people who are in charge of this department, send them the stuff. Obviously, they'll ignore you because they don't know who you are. Get them on the phone, find a way to get into a room with them, pitch to them. And they liked the sound of my pitch. And I expected to get on their radar for the opportunity that came up next. I very much did not expect to follow Will Buxton into the commentary box. I remember the taxi from the airport in Bahrain to the hotel for the rest of my life, because you're thinking, well, the last game I did, I was on the back row of a freezing football stand, and now I'm about to do commentary on a Grand Prix weekend. And, you know, just remarkable that they gave me that chance, but even more remarkable that then they stood by me and gave me the opportunity to find my feet with the role, because nothing compares to the setup and the sprawl of a Grand Prix weekend. And when you're put in the back of the gallery and handed a microphone, everyone's been doing their jobs effortlessly for years, and then suddenly you're the worst of their pitchers, you feel an awful lot of pressure. I love those championships. As you could tell with Formula 3 this weekend, you know, Lorenzo Colombo, denied the week before, comes back and shows the tenacity to absolutely torch the field. Phenomenal mental response. And I love that journey that the drivers go on, and it informs. You know, there's a journey that goes on. And when you see someone like George Russell win the GP3 championship, become Formula 2 champion, and then put it on the front row, it's almost like hearing a great band's early work. And I think that really helps my F1 commentary as well, having seen the progression of the careers up to the top tier.
Oh, man, you already sold me on your pitch. You can host this show if you really want. Like that, I love those kinds of stories, and part of the reason why I developed this podcast was to hear those kinds of stories where guys come in or from the ground level and they make it to what it is. And let's be honest, you look at what Formula 2, then GB2, the kind of TV broadcast from then to now, is it's grown exponentially. And I think a lot of us are really fortunate that we have a world feed commentary that matches the action, as we, you know, as we saw with the F3 race 3 last night or yesterday afternoon in Europe, with Jack Doohan and Victor Martins, who produced an incredible Grand Prix race, and hopefully Doohan, hopefully as an Australian, will make his way to Formula One. I gotta have a bit of Australian propaganda in there, but yeah. I guess I'm going to pivot a little bit, because I do want to talk about the championship in Formula 3, which Dennis Hauger, leading at the moment, had a rough weekend, salvaged some points in race 3. Doohan was the big benefactor of this, winning the race 2 and 3. It's set up for the final few races to be a very tantalizing finish to the season, and hopefully Doohan nicks it, but I think it's very much set up for an incredible finish in Austin, Texas.
It really is. And for so much of this, I almost feel bad for Dennis Hauger, because he's gone so long into the season without having his bad round. I've been covering it a long time now. You always have a bad round. And this year with the format, if you have, you know, bad race one or a bad qualifying session, you're in a dollop of trouble, let's be honest. And it's happened to all of the other rivals, and it was always going to happen to him. I actually think it's played out quite nicely for him that it's not towards the end, because if you look at the championship last year, where the Pramers seem to have it completely set up, Sargeant versus Piastri, and then one thing leads to another thing. And if you have that, you know, if you're in Monza and it starts crumbling, you've got to respond And that championship was so tightly packed in last year that that was a real test. And Piastri kept his head really nicely. When you look at this year's championship, Hauger's just doing what he did in Italian Formula 4. He knows how to dominate championships. He's also driven with real authority. We saw it again. He was able to put the car places yesterday that others weren't, overtaking around the outside of Le Mans. And then, you know, and then he couldn't get past David Schumacher. And the thing is, he didn't try a rash move. So he's thought about the championship. If he gets Friday qualifying right, you're expecting Doohan to be at the front, Hauger to be at the front, and a more normal weekend. But everyone has a round where it doesn't go to plan. That always happens. He's had that. It's out of the way. So then the question then becomes, can anyone take advantage? And Jack Doohan has turned a 63-point deficit into a 25-point deficit. He's given himself every single chance. And the great thing about racing on the Grand Prix weekend for Formula 3, because I know it hasn't always been the case, but the great thing is people would have noticed that he took his opportunities. He's a brilliantly likable, affable, but great intensity. I said in the commentary, very reminiscent for me of Mick Schumacher. He's got that surname pressure, but he's just pouring his whole heart and soul into being a racing driver. And the truth is, I mean, Hauger's super committed as well. But the truth is, not everyone does that. Not everyone lives and breathes it. And sometimes that intensity can work against you. But it was wonderful to see. It's great to see two drivers as well who had flashes of brilliance last year, able to show us consistently through the season what they're capable of.
100%. And the big thing is, not only are they championship rivals, but down the line, potentially, they might be fighting for a seat with, say, AlphaTauri, as they are part of the Red Bull Academy program, which has an endless list of high-quality drivers, as we've seen in Formula 2 as well. And then you go up to the ranks this year and you look at Yuki Tsunoda, who's having a funny old rookie campaign where he can't keep it out of the wall. But
he's having a classic rookie campaign, Matthew. I would say that, you know, the standard of Formula 1 these days is so high, like the quality of the grid is so high that Yuki is putting together what in other years would have been considered a very typical rookie campaign. But the problem is, when your teammate's a race winner, when you've got people in the mid pack who are race winners, every error gets exemplified. So also, it's a really intense run to go from Japanese F4, Formula 3. You know, 2 years ago, he hadn't even scored a podium until Spa. Now he's in Formula 1. So it's been a rapid ascent for him. And I think the season he's having kind of reflects that.
Do you also think maybe because of the likes of Russell, Leclerc, Verstappen, guys who have come in their rookie seasons and produced very good performances, that's kind of almost moved the goalpost in terms of what we expect of rookies?
Yeah, I think that's an entirely fair thing to say. I also think you've listed three drivers that are going to win the world championship in the next 15 years. So, and I think they're going to share them between each other. And I'm trying to think if I believe that anyone else will get amongst that. Lando Norris is going to have something to say about that, definitely. But the standard of the rookies, as a result, that what they're doing is not normal. Their standard is incredibly high. You know, things like Charles Leclerc's brilliant Formula 2 campaign, you just become used to it. And Max, clearly born to be the driver that he is, just immediately thrown into it, somehow finds a way to cope, improves every single season. You know, that standard is elite tier. But to make it to Formula One, not everyone is going to be of that final, you know, roaring 0.2 second ultimate pace. And it's always been that way. But yeah, I think that their rookie performances have somewhat skewed the picture, if you like.
Yeah. And it's, even though, like, you look back and even my comments are a bit unfair, because Yuki has, on his day, proven that he can get in the points, just needs to work on the qualifying, I guess. But it takes time. Unfortunately for him, he's a part of a group that isn't really forgiving when you take your time. You look at Pierre Gasly's short term at Red Bull, Kvyat obviously getting ousted on more than one occasion from that program. It's a tough caper, and really it's a sink or swim business. And, you know, it will be interesting to see how Yuki progresses, but I'm also interested to see how the next group of rookies come in. And I think one person that we should definitely talk about, as it may look like the Alfa Romeo could change their driver lineup, would be Teo Pourchaire, the French superstar in Formula 2, who is in his rookie season in F2 with ART. He's producing a very strong campaign, and it's fair to say that he's making a very good case to potentially get an F1 seat next season.
He certainly put himself in that conversation, hasn't he? His performance in Monaco was surprise. I tell you what, when he's team boss, if you consider Sebastian Philippe has worked with some serious champions that have gone through the ranks, and yeah, if you consider the drivers he's had moved past, and he said he was surprised at what Pourchaire was able to do, I think that shows you how impressed they were with his Monaco performance. I sometimes think there are drivers that the motorsport community just immediately take to, and he appears to be one of them. I don't know whether it's the age thing. I don't know whether it's because he's a really lovely guy, but I remember speaking to him in Formula 3 last year and him saying, I don't really know where I'm going to fit in here. He's another driver who's just instantly promoted up through the ranks, and then the growing belief. And I have to say, I do like the journey. I do like seeing drivers go, oh, now I believe I can do it. The great example of this is Antonio Giovinazzi, who finished runner-up in GP2 in 2016, who really did believe he was going to have a DTM career, and that was about his level. Gets his chance in single-seaters, and the belief growing all the time was a wonderful thing to see, and he staked his claim in Formula 1. But now we've got Teo knocking on the door. Obviously, he had that injury, which he's still going to be dealing with. He rushed himself back into the car because he's a racing driver and they're not normal people. They're absolutely compelled to do this. So whereas you or I, Matthew, might be like, actually, I mean, that wrist is hurting an awful lot. He's like, I'm getting back in the car. I'm remaining a contender. I'm doing everything I can. I don't know. I would perhaps err on the side of caution. I said this with Yuki last year. I'd perhaps err on the side of caution. Does he have the talent to make Formula 1? Absolutely. Do I think he's going to get there? Yeah, I do. But you can say that about a lot of drivers. You can say that about an awful lot of drivers. And sometimes the motorsport world can be cruel, and it doesn't always work out for one reason or another. But his talent at such a young age has been a brilliant thing to watch in the last couple of years.
100%. And he was also, we talked about that F3 campaign last season. He got himself in the mix right at the very end. And he almost actually, you know, I guess I'm going to use a Australianism. He almost Stephen Bradbury'd his way to the title where Sargeant and Piastri had that rough round in Monza, and then obviously Sargeant DNF'd in the final race at Mugello. He nearly found himself as title winner number one in extraordinary circumstances. And I do love Stephen Bradbury. He's you know, Winter Olympics special. So I guess it would be a miss then, as you're here, to talk about the F1 season, which is interesting, because I'm almost reminiscent of the 2008 season where they were getting ready for a rule change. Teams were getting ready to, you know, a lot of teams were focusing on 2009, and obviously you had the Titanic battle between Hamilton and Felipe Massa. Hamilton is there again, but this time his adversary is Max Verstappen, and I think we all firmly believe that this one is going down to the wire. What's been your overall impression of that, the season so far, and how long until we probably see these two go have a... I'm not going to say they're going to have a massive accident, but it's fair to say there is going to be a crescendo at some stage of the season where these two will get tangled again.
Yeah, I think it's inevitable because of the intensity of this title fight, which is one of the best for years. I mean, to see drivers, you know, compare it to, you mentioned 2008. I think it's an entirely valid comparison, and some great races there. But if you think about something like 1997, when Villeneuve and Schumacher weren't on the same podium together once, right? One of the weirdest stats in the history of Formula One that. But it just shows you that, you know, you weren't really getting, you were getting the ebb and flow of a championship battle, but you weren't getting the amazing fights that we've been having across this year. You know, Max going from third to first in Imola, and Lewis just about avoiding contact. Lewis's brilliant moves at Portimao. It's just, you know, and then obviously Silverstone, which was until, and I'm not going to go back into what happened at Cox. but what I am going to underline is for everything that happened until that, that is some of the most exciting Formula One I've ever seen. That is one of the greatest brawls on an opening lap I've ever witnessed, the eight corners before. I have to say, as a commentary moment, as a spectacle, to have the years that we've had and then suddenly put 140,000 people around Silverstone Circuit. It felt like we'd been broadcasting in black and white for the earlier part of the year. And then it felt like we were in HD color, and it was vivid. And it just felt like someone had plugged the speaker back in, which is that it felt like someone had plugged an amp back in. And and then to put on that weekend and qualifying was, you know, really special. Then you have the sprint race where everyone's like, which way is this going to go? And then to have that opening lap was an amazing spectacle. And I think it's a great shame they didn't both make it across there, because I wanted more laps like that. Because, yes, I know that everything we know about motor racing tells us that you can't do that lap after lap after lap. And maybe Lewis had taken the rear wing off to get past him on the hanger straight. But those two are at a level and are producing a season of driving that is, you know, very, very, very special. And all the comparisons to Prost and Senna and all the references to previous title battles that you would get, you know, you would get thrown around, and maybe they wouldn't be applicable. They are applicable. This is a heavyweight contest. For Verstappen, for Hamilton, this is almost worth two titles. When you look at the competition, this one is going to be so sweet for whoever takes it, because if you're Max Verstappen, it's your first title and you've denied one of the greatest drivers of all time. If you're Lewis Hamilton, you've broken new ground, and you've broken it against a guy who it just obviously is going to take multiple titles and has done terrific things with the car. It's been almost dizzying to the point where it's like someone has said after that. And again, I go back, sport is always wrapped around the context that it, you know, socially and obviously what we've been going through with the pandemic, to be having this season at this time, it feels like all of the action has been crammed into one unbelievable campaign after the last few years that we've had, where, yeah, there have been great races, but suddenly now, after waiting, we've got an inter-team battle, and that just ramps it up. It just makes it more intense. And yeah, I think it is just brilliant. It is just brilliant to watch. And I can't wait. I genuinely can't wait to see how it turns out.
And you know, heading into this weekend, which is Max's home Grand Prix, it's just going to be orange, just littered in orange all across the circuit. So the equivalent of, like, I don't know, an Ashes series in Australia where England are coming. It's going to be that kind of intensity. And you know for a fact that if anyone but Verstappen doesn't win the Grand Prix, there's going to be some eyes kind of looking the other way, like, yo, Max, you need to win this Grand Prix. We waited. Yeah. We missed out last year. We got to win. I think we're all in it together when it comes to the ride of the season, because you look at the last few seasons, and as you said, haven't seen the title fight we've wanted, and now we've got it. And you've also got to, and even off the track, with Horner and Toto Wolff, and that in itself is its own little rivalry. They are friendly to an extent, but you can tell that there is there's that little bit of animosity. And I tell you what, Drive to Survive Season 4 is going to be good fun.
Yeah, have fun editing that. My word. I mean, having to cram in all the narratives into what do they normally do? 8 episodes? 10 episodes? I think they might have to stretch it. I think they might have to. I mean, and again, if we get a title decider and they've made changes to Abu Dhabi as well, so it could be a title decider where they could actually race. That would be very, very, very special. Yeah, just to, on the point, I've been saying that this is quite a rare thing in Formula One, in that in Europe there's always an orange army for Max Verstappen, but this isn't effectively, to put it in football terms, your Ashes example is fair, but to put it in football or soccer terms, this is an away game for Hamilton.
Yeah.
This is a real away game, and the Silverstone crowd loves its motor racing. And I've heard partisan reactions in the crowd before, but we know what Hamilton's going to face at Zandvoort. And it's going to be quite unusual for a driver. And to be honest, let's underline it. You can get hurt doing this. All right. This is not the pantomime stuff of other sports. You shouldn't be booing anyone who's risking their neck, would be what I would say, first of all. But yeah, it's an away game. It's like playing a Champions League game away in Russia or Turkey, where the atmospheres are so hostile, and Hamilton has to deal with that. But I always think, you know, the driver, you talk about where drivers are strong and where drivers aren't. In close combat, he just relishes it. And the opportunities at Zandvoort are going to be limited, and they are going to be key moments. The start's going to be key. The in-lap's going to be key. The out-lap's going to be key. And given the season that we've seen so far, the proximity of those two to each other could be very, very tight indeed. So it's going to come down to flashpoints once again. But Hamilton's going to have to deal with an atmosphere. Yeah, obviously Sebastian Vettel went through a phase where people didn't love what he did in Malaysia to Mr. Webber. And I'm just trying to think of comparisons to that, where normally it's not a partisan crowd, in that you might get cheering, but the booing is a weird one. And yeah, how Hamilton deals with that will be interesting to see.
I also think we're talking about the championship fight before, where winning the world title would be double. You would argue this would be like scoring an away goal, which, like, that's how big it'll be for Hamilton if he can win in the Netherlands.
Yeah, I think it's just, I agree with that as well, in that you saw the biggest brawl between them at Hamilton's home race. I don't think that's a coincidence. Mm-hmm. You've got to remember, and one of the great things about this year is the driver is making the difference. They're evenly matched cars. It's pendulum swinging week to week, but the driver is making the difference. But they are human beings, and they can't help but rise to the occasion. And you know, I think the reason that we got such a spectacle at Silverstone was because the fans were back, it was noisy, it was the height of summer, and we're going, I think, back into a similar situation at Zandvoort. Great to get a new European race, kind of rare. I don't think that happens too often. Haven't raced at that circuit. It's obviously been completely modified since the 80s, but always good to go somewhere new. Always good to try something. But quite rare to go somewhere new with a previous history like Zandvoort has.
Yeah, it's going to be super exciting. Before you go, this has been an incredible conversation, and I wish it didn't have to end, but that is the fact. This is the reality of podcasting. I asked this question to Will Buxton earlier in the season.
Who? No, yes.
I'm going to tell him that. I'll just that'll be the preview. In Formula One, the video game, which I've got my rig behind me, you can create your 11th team. And unlike the restrictions in the video game, if, let's say, Alex Jakes Motorsport enters Formula One in 2022, who would be your driver lineup? Of course, you can't pick any of the drivers that are off the market or currently at teams. What would your driver lineup look like?
Nice. Well, I think it's about time that Mika Hakkinen ended his sabbatical. but that's because I was just a Mika fan growing up. In all seriousness, I'd probably go for Pato O'Ward, because I think he's doing brilliant things in IndyCar. He's a nice guy as well. When he had a chance to meet him when he got parachuted in to do one F2 round, and we never saw him again. But he's doing brilliant things, and what a great campaign he's putting together in IndyCar. And Alex Albon. Alex Albon, talk about wrong place, wrong time. What a strange Formula One career that kid had, but I think he deserves another go. Look, if all the people that were racing him think he has phenomenal natural ability, surely you just need to find him the right environment. And this hypothetical 11th team that I have somehow found 200 million euros to enter would have those two, because I think that'd be an exciting lineup, and I think they'd be very, very competitive.
I love that. For reference, I think I went with Nyck de Vries and Stoffel Vandoorne, which is incidentally the former Mercedes EQ team, because they're now out of Formula E. So I'm giving them a home. They're coming home. They're back in Formula One. Well, de Vries, of course.
And both drivers who deserved, in Stoffel's case, very similar, just at McLaren at the wrong period of the team's history, and quick Nick. Well, he's always been absolutely rapid. And if you look at that amazing year where we had Russell, then we had Norris, then we had Albon, Nyck de Vries is only about 10 points off the back of those guys, and on his day is very difficult to deal with. And I think for a team at the back where you have to take your chances, quick Nick is not a bad shout.
100%. Alex, it's been an absolute privilege to have you on. Thank you so much for your time, and I wish you all the luck covering what is going to be a titanic Formula One season.
I cannot wait. Great to speak to you, Matthew.
It was great chatting to Alex about his career and the incredible title fight in Formula One this season. Alex shared some brilliant stories, and I particularly enjoyed some of his experiences outside of the world of motorsport. Like, for example, providing comms and interviews for the sport of fencing. It's not something you would particularly associate with the brilliant talent source of Alex. Alex, it was an absolute pleasure to have you on the podcast, and I can't wait to hear your commentary for many years to come. Tune in next time for another edition of One on One, and if you've missed any of my previous episodes, including my Nyck de Vries, the Formula E World Champion, or with Will Buxton, then go check them out. To stay up to date with the podcast, go follow me at Matthew Carriage on Twitter, and hopefully soon I'll have another episode for you. Thank you so much for listening, and I'll see you next time.